Thank you, Mr. Cabot.
Brother Bill. Bleeding Deacon. I'm Chuck Stewart. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I want to thank the committee for allowing me the privilege of sharing this weekend with you. Up until now, it's been good. I'm certainly glad to see that we have some people in front of us. Up until 10 minutes ago, we were going to have to talk. The only person I know that could do that successfully would be Clancy. And he's out here. The chairman said I was just drunk like the rest of it. I don't hardly think that's true. Some ought to think we're a cut above. I don't know what we're going to talk about tonight, but I suspect it'll be about me. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, perhaps, if I don't get sidetracked. I've had a few people that wanted me to tell the Blue Jay story. I hate to do it because it takes too much time, but I haven't used it for a long time, and I might as well tell it. I was what they say in Texas, I was bad to drink. It's a good old Texas saying, is I was bad to drink. I did lots of my drinking in bed because I couldn't get up. That's why I did it that way. And I spent long periods in bed. We had a sort of a tropical fruit tree of some kind right out of my bedroom window. And the stuff in season would have fruit on it. And it was sort of an inverted bunch of grapes. A little bigger than grapes, but it reminded you of a bunch of grapes upside down. And when the fruit would get ripe, the small birds would eat it. But they'd leave the seeds on the tree. And there were a pair of blue jays that liked to eat those seeds. And I'd be lying there dying in bed. And just about the crack of dawn, just about daylight, here would come these two blue jays. And they'd start squawking. And I'm lying there dying, and I figured that they were telling me what a bum I was, you know. Here's a new day, and you're not going to be with it. Oh, boy. And so, they had no right to tell me that. And I developed a hatred towards those blue jays. And as time went on, it got to be quite a hatred. And I was thinking of ways and means to get rid of them. Now, I could have shot them, but that was too good for them. I didn't want them to get by that easily. So I dreamed up a dream that went something like this. I was going to trap them. And when I trapped them, then I was going to take them one at a time, and I was going to pull the feathers out of them one at a time. And when I got them totally naked, I was going to stick them back in one at a time. Because they didn't have any right to tell me what a bum I was. Well, in due course of time, I got sober. And I got interested in those blue jays. And I started talking to them, and they started talking to me. And the first thing you know, I had those blue jays, so they'd come from any place in the city. We lived in Beverly Hills at the time. And light in my hand. And I'd feed them nuts. And we got to be great, great friends. And every once in a while, I would give them an almond. Now, they didn't like almonds. But I'd give them an almond, and they'd take the thing up on top of the house next door and peck at it a couple of times. And then they'd come back and sit in my hand and peck the hell out of my thumb and just cuss me up one side and down the other for feeding them nuts that they didn't like. So we had a sort of a thing going there. But after I was sober 11 years, Mrs. C wanted to move. And I didn't want to move. And the biggest part of the reason I didn't want to move away from my blue jays. Because we had quite a love affair going at that time. And she insisted that we move, and so we finally did. And now I got me another pair of blue jays down at the beach. They don't sit in my hand yet, but I'll have them before the season's out. And it's just sort of a way to show you how frustrated we were with ourselves when we have to figure that a couple of blue jays are telling us what bums we are, you know. That was one thing. And about that time, there was a fellow in pictures by the name of Mr. Jordan. And Mr. Jordan depicted death. When he showed up on the scene, some of you might remember it. It was death. And about the time I was getting ready to destroy the blue jays, I'd look out there, and if they weren't there, Mr. Jordan would be pulling the leaves apart. And every time I'd look, there he was, pulling the leaves apart and looking at me just to see if it was time for him to take me. And that was sort of frustrating, too, you know. Death sitting there just waiting for me to get ripe. So we're a peculiar breed of cats. We're a peculiar breed of cats. Up until my last drunk, it never occurred to me that I was at fault. It never occurred to me that I was at fault with my drinking. Up until my very last drunk, I had a perfectly legitimate reason for every drunk I ever went on. It wasn't my fault. It was your fault. That you stupid people, mean people, hadn't lived like I knew you should, and like I told you how, I wouldn't have had to get drunk at you. But you wouldn't do it. So it was your fault that I drank. It was my wife's fault. But more than you or my wife, it was my wife's mother. Now there was a king-size reason for getting drunk. That old biddy had only one child, and I was married to her. And she was living with us. And she had a grandson seat watching me crucify her only daughter. And she didn't like me very good. And I didn't like her that good. Because you see, if she hadn't been living with us, I wouldn't have had to crucify her daughter. So it was all her fault. But never mind. And on my last drunk. And I came to see you that time that if there be fault, it's mine. And I haven't had a drink anymore. But anyway, it's amazing. Because Mrs. C's mother lived with us 5 years before I sobered up, and 5 years after I sobered up before her death. And it was absolutely amazing what this program did for her in those last 5 years. My last drunk started the Friday before Christmas, 1945. I'd had a little good fortune. My boss man had called me in Friday before Christmas, and I knew that he'd called me in to sever my connection with the company because I knew that I had it coming. And I went in wishing I didn't have to. But instead of shooting me, as he had every right to do, he started talking, which was a good sign. And this is what he said to me. He says, "Charlie, you've had a lot of trouble this year." Now, he never mentioned booze, but he knew that I knew what he was talking about when he said trouble. And he, being a non-alcoholic, had it all figured out. He says, "I think it's because of the pressure you're under." Now, he says, "I'm going to take a little of the pressure off of you. And maybe next year you won't have so much pressure, and you won't have so much trouble." And so instead of shooting me, he had every right to, he gave me $3,000 for a Christmas present. The Friday before Christmas, 1945. To take the pressure off of me. And if you don't think you took the pressure off of me, you're nuts. There's one thing that's worse for an alcoholic than bad fortune, and that's good fortune. So I got drunk on the way home. Now this was impossible because I was a periodic for the last 12 years that I drank. And periodics don't get drunk on the way home. Periodics never taper off, they taper on. We have a very definite routine. We drink till we can't get it up and can't get it down. Can't live and can't die. And then we have to knock it off. And in my day, there was no way that, no place to go. They didn't have it as easy as they do now, where they can take you to many, many places to get you down off a drunk without having to die that much. But the only way I could get sober was to die till it got well. You know? And of course, It was tough. And then when we'd start getting better, we would start analyzing our last drink. Because we got to see where we made our mistakes, you know. And we'd decide where we'd made our mistakes and decide that we weren't going to do it that way anymore. So we had it all settled, you know. And a little while after that, we'd start sampling. And we'd sample our way right on back to bed. But not quickly. Usually it would take me from 30 to 60 days to get off my feet after my first slug, after a dry spell. But my last trip out, I got drunk on the way home. I don't remember anything from the Friday before Christmas, 1945, to the middle of January, 1946. I remember nothing. So, it's a strange thing that after all the experience I'd had, that I would get drunk on the way home, but I did. And when I came to, in the middle of January 1946, a strange thing had happened. Everything between me and me had burned out. All the excuses were gone. All the wants were gone. There wasn't anything between me and me. And for the first time in my life, I could see me as I was. And I knew without knowing why that I'd lost the battle of life. And it was the first time in 43 years of life that I had ever admitted defeat. Not once in 43 years had I ever admitted defeat until that morning. And I knew that I'd lost the battle of life. I didn't know why, because I knew nothing of alcoholism. I just knew that I'd lost the battle of life. I knew why my good wife was divorcing me after 20 years. And I might say quickly, without cause. I'd given her 20 of the best years of my life, and she's divorcing me. And I knew why. And I knew she should have done it 10 years before. And I knew why our kids wouldn't come home when I was around. And I knew why this same boss man had sent word to the house that if I ever stepped foot in the plant again, he was going to throw me through the window. And the window that he had picked out for that purpose, both opened. It was a plate glass deal. I accepted the fact that morning that everything dear to me in life was gone and should be gone, and that I was not entitled to have it back. Now, I want to say that again, because this is what my life has been built on for the last 34 years. I totally and completely accepted the fact that everything dear to me in life was gone and should be gone, and that I wasn't entitled to have it back. I also accepted death, because I'd come that close to dying the next to the last time out. The next to the last time out, I'd gone to the kitchen in my withdrawal period to get a glass of buttermilk. Mrs. C. and Richard were sitting in the living room. They heard me let out a bellow and heard me hit the floor. And they came running out thinking that I was in an alcoholic convulsion, which was my want. And they might be able to keep me from swelled in my tongue. But I wasn't convulsing. I'd already used up all my convulsions. I was lying there on the kitchen floor as peaceful as anybody you ever saw. I wasn't doing nothing. They told me I was a peculiar color. I was blue. And they couldn't wake me up. So they got all exercise and called the oxygen squad at the Beverly Hills Receiving Hospital to send down a squad and see what they could do for me. And they did. And I have reason to believe that they brought me two. I remember what happened after I came to. There was a young doctor with this crew, and he said to me, son, he says, to all intents and purposes, you were dead. He says, we've had a hell of a time bringing you to. And it's our opinion that nobody will ever bring you to again under these circumstances. And then he gave me the finest piece of counsel I will ever hear. He looked me right in the eye and he said, if I were you, I wouldn't do that anymore. Now I'm going to pass that on. If I were you, I wouldn't do that anymore. But I did it again. And the last time was worse than the next to the last time. So I knew I was going to die, and it was all right. But I didn't want to die with the record. I didn't want to die with the record. I didn't want my wife and my kids to remember me. There's nothing but a tongue-chewing, babbling, idiot drunk. Became very necessary that I spend whatever time I had before I kicked off trying to rub out the record before I died. And I remembered that morning that Mrs. C had read Jack Alexander's article in the Post in March 1941. And she had thought it might be of some value to me. And she had left it open at the right page on the left arm of the chair I sit in right now. And that morning I remembered the article. I remembered that I'd read it. There was only two things about it that I remembered, because I was drunk when I read it. I remembered that drunks helped drunks and didn't drink, and they called it Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I will find AA. And immediately, the curtain dropped. My little period of sanity was gone, and I was sick to death, drunk and insane. And I had a lot of dying to do. But from the very second of commitment until right now, I have never had a drink of alcoholic beverage of any kind, or a pill or potter acid. Anything of that nature, I've never had. From the moment of commitment. So, it is my opinion that the cure for our disease is the toughest thing we'll ever have to be confronted with. And that's surrender. Surrender. Surrender is victory for the alcoholic. And that's why it's so tough for us. The alcoholic personality was not born to surrender. We were born to win. And we damn near did it. I call us the almost people. Almost without president in the United States. But I got just a little teensy bit alcoholic. And that's all, brother. That's all. I had never surrendered once in 43 years, as I told you. But that morning, I knew that surrender was victory. And so I've never had to have a drink since then. Now when I got a little better, it took a while because I had a lot of dying to do. But when I got a little better, I started trying to figure out how to find Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I ran out of time, good drinking time, before Alcoholics Anonymous was born. Our society is 44 years old, the 10th of last June. We were 44 years old. And I was out of good drinking time before the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous was born. And so I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had another 12 years to drink after I'd run out of time. Because, you see, I knew that I hadn't run out of time. It took me 12 years to finish it up. So, I knew that I was done. I was all right, but I must use whatever time I had left to rub out the record. Now, I never got to the point during the whole time that I drank, which was over 25 years, where I didn't love my wife and my kids. They knew I didn't. I guess Mrs. C has told me 500 times, "Chuck, if you loved us, you wouldn't do these things." Well, how could I tell her it was because I loved them that I did? You can't sell that kind of a bill of goods, you know. And yet it was true. Because, as I said, I was a periodic. And between drunks, when I was physically as dry as I am right now, I would look at my conduct, and I knew I was crucifying my wife and my kids. And I knew I loved them, and I didn't want to crucify them. I wanted to take them in my arms and say, "Look, I'll never do this again. I love you. I'll never do it again." But I couldn't. Because, you see, I'd already done it. And the upshot of it was I'd get to hurting so bad right here. I'd have to go out and get another supply. And get drunk all over again and crucify him again. Such is the vicious circle that we're up against when we're alcoholics. Took me a little while to get well. Well enough to look for AA. And when I got well enough, I started looking. I knew that you wouldn't be in the phone book because you were anonymous, weren't you? They don't anonymous in the phone book. So knowing you weren't in the phone book, I never looked, which is the story of my life. I knew so damn much that it wasn't true, I couldn't learn anything it was. So I had to call people and ask them if they knew anybody that knew anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I finally got a hold of a chap in Beverly Hills. He was a motion picture actor. I got his name and telephone number from a doctor in Beverly. And I called him. Told him what I'd called him for, and we talked a little while. And he finally said to me, "Have you had a drink today?" And I said, "No." But he says, "Don't take one." He says, "Tonight I'm working. And I can't take you to a meeting, but maybe tomorrow night I won't be working. So call me tomorrow. But don't drink." And I called him tomorrow, and we talked a little while, and he says, "Have you had a drink today?" And I said, "No." He says, "Don't take one, I'm still working. Call me tomorrow." So I called him the third day. And we got going, and I could tell by the way he talked that he was still working. And I said, I know. You're still working. He says, yes. I says, you don't need to take me to meeting. Where is there a meeting that I can go to? I'll go under my own power. And he told me where there was a meeting, and it wasn't very far from where I lived. And I had determined to go. And it was all right until about 30 minutes before I was supposed to go to the meeting. And I got to thinking. It's awful bad for an elk to think. And what I was thinking about was maybe I shouldn't be seen with people like you. Maybe you would be bad for my reputation. After all, I live in Beverly Hills, didn't I? Now, you'll never know how funny this is. Because in my last 10 years, I'd spent about as much time in the Beverly Hills jailhouse as the jailer did. And yeah, I was worried about being seen with people like you. But I thought it over, and I decided to disguise myself a little bit, which I did. And I sallied forth. I get there perhaps 10 minutes before the meeting was to take up, and there were probably 35, maybe 40 people standing in the middle of the room. Every one of them talking, nobody listening. It's been that way ever since. And I looked you over, and again, my keen alcoholic mind told me that they'd given me the wrong dope. That you weren't alcoholics at all. This was the Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall, and you were veterans and their wives, and they were there for a party. And I was going to have to leave and come back tonight. The drunks were there. Because, you see, you didn't look like me. And you weren't dressed like me. And most certainly, you weren't talking like me, because it was all happy talk. So I knew that you weren't drunks. And I said to me, I'm going to have to leave and come back tonight. The drunks are here. And I turned to leave. And the next minute is Alcoholics Anonymous, as far as I'm concerned. That is the very next minute of this talk is the essence of Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody in the middle of that group had been watching me. And when I turned to leave, he came trotting over to the door. And he called after me. He says, Mister, were you looking for somebody? And I said, no, sir. Well, he says, what were you looking for then? And thinking he was a veteran, I said, well, if it would interest you, sir, I was looking for sobriety. And everything about that man changed just like that. He lit up like a Christmas tree. And it was obvious to me that he was glad I was there. Now, some of you in the room would know how that made me feel. Here was a man I'd never seen before that was so glad I was there. He lit up like a Christmas tree. Well, everybody that knew me was glad I was there, too. But for a different reason. If I was there, I couldn't be here. But that wasn't the case with this guy. He was just plumb glad I was there. And I wasn't a bargain, I'll tell you that. I was a mess. But to him, I was a bargain. And I was hooked before he ever opened his mouth again. And when he did, this is what he said. Why, take off your hat and coat. You're in the right place. Then he took me in, rocked me asleep. This is a This is AA. Without this, no recovery at all, in my opinion. I do not believe that there's enough intellectual knowledge on the face of the earth to get one alcoholic sober and keep him sober. I don't believe there is. We don't get sober by profundities or principles. We are allowed to get sober by the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. We maintain sobriety by the practice of the principles. But getting sober, it's by the spirit. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share. Share. Caring and sharing is Alcoholics Anonymous. Did it ever occur to you how fortunate we are that we love each other? Did that ever occur to you? You know, a wet drunk is not easy to love, is he? It just about takes one to love one, right? And here this guy was so glad I was there that he lit up like a Christmas tree. Now, without making any reference to judgment, because I don't expect the non-alcoholic world to understand me, because I don't understand me myself. I can't understand how you could be a periodic sober between every two drunks for 12 years and still get drunk again. I can look at my record with physically sober eyes between drunks, and I could always come up with the conclusion that I'd learned my lesson. Next time it's going to be different. And I had quite a record by this time. You start in, and maybe it's not too long till you start having a little trouble. But it's right around home. It's right around home, around the house. You're in trouble. And a little later, your trouble starts to spread. And every place you go, your trouble goes. For instance, I had a lot of trouble with fleas. I've only run into 9 people in 34 years that had the trouble with fleas that I did. My bedroom would get 10 billion fleas in. And I'd lie there and try to get them off of me, and I'd work on them, you know, trying to get them off. They'd roll over my hands. And I'd wear myself out trying to get rid of those fleas. Then you just had to lie there and breathe fleas. Now that ain't good living. The fleas finally turned into spiders as big as this podium. And they'd be coming down from the ceiling. I'd see them up there, and I knew they weren't there. You know, I knew they weren't there. And I decided to never look at them again, see. Next thing you know, I was looking. And they were still there. A little bit later, I'd be fastened onto those damn spiders. And here they'd come, right down my face. That's nerve-wracking. A little later on, the spiders became elephants. I'm one of the few people that ever lived in Beverly Hills that were charged by a herd of elephants. That almost never happens in Beverly Hills. But they damn near ran me out of this county. I had a great deal of trouble with music, with no visible means of support. I'll never forget the first time I heard the music. I'd gone to the kitchen again after quite a siege to get a glass of buttermilk. And this particular occasion, the tea kettle was on the stove. And out of the steam came the most beautiful symphony I ever heard in my life. And I backed up and I looked that situation over. And I said, this is the greatest phenomenon of modern times. This old T-shirt has suddenly become a receiving set. Then I made me a big mistake. I went out and herded the family in to listen to music. They couldn't hear nothing. And I thought they were nuts. I lived to hear a dozen bands at once. All of them with a different announcer. All of them playing different music. And music came out of some peculiar places. It would come out of the lights. Come out of the heaters. Come out of the toilet. You know. Lots of good music, but you couldn't turn it off. Who had any knobs? No knobs. Little later on, I was meeting the people. And they weren't there. I suspect this is the worst thing that my family had to put up with. Quite often, we'd all be in the same living room. And I'd have company, and they wouldn't have any. I can imagine that'd be a weird thing to watch. And a little later on, I was coming to with cuts and bruises all over me. A tongue that thick, all full of holes. They call that an alcoholic convulsion. And I had to run out of convulsions before I could come to you people for help. Now, I can't understand that kind of performance, because, mind you, I could look at that record, Between Drunks, when I was physically as dry as I am right now. And always up until my last drunk, I could convince myself that I'd learned a lesson. Next time it was going to be different, and of course it was. It was worse than it always had been. So I don't expect the non-alcoholic world to understand this at all. That isn't why I say what I'm saying. But if a non-alcoholic sees one of us in the gutter, they give us a wide berth. They know that if we had any willpower, backbone, we wouldn't be there, you know. So they give us a wide berth. We have no character, no willpower, no backbone. But when you and I see one of us in the gutter, we know that he isn't there because he wants to be. We know that he hates that gutter worse than anybody in the face of the earth because he's been there before. He hates it. And he's there because he has to be. He don't know how not to be there. And so we understand that. And we can go get him like the guy came over the door after me. We can go get him, take him home with us, and rock him to sleep like they did me. They told me the first night what I'd never heard in my entire 25 years of drinking. They told me that if I was an alcoholic, one drink was too many, and 1,000 weren't enough. Said people like you to me, one drink is too many and 1,000 aren't enough. It's the first drink that's killing you. I had always thought it was the last gallon. I was trying to find a way to knock it off before the trouble started, you know? For instance, I'd look at the performance And I'd say to myself, you got in the pokey on Wednesday. Now, if you'd have quit on Tuesday, they couldn't have caught you on Wednesday. So I decided to knock it off Tuesday the next week, the next time. But I forget to specify which Tuesday. So, it's a frustrating life, to say the least. The second thing you told me is today is the day we don't drink. Today is the day we don't drink. Now, if they had told me I had to be sober 34 years, I'd have dropped dead. You know. If they had told me 34 days, I'd have dropped dead. But he said, today is the day we don't drink. And you said to me that very first night, regardless of how long you live in Alcoholics Anonymous, never expand that time more than 24 hours. Make that the length of your life. 24 hours. And we don't drink today. And I bought it. And I've never gotten rid of it. In my opinion, it's the second greatest lesson I ever learned. The second greatest lesson I ever learned. This is my day. I have no past. I want no future. And I've lived it for 34 years. And it's fantastic. You know, the past has nothing in the world but guilt. And the future is nothing but fear. And if you haven't got either one of them, it just leaves today. And today isn't so bad. Really. We can make it one day at a time. So the second greatest lesson I ever learned is this is my day. I have no past. I want no future. The third thing you told me was stay close to us. Said you, there is more wisdom in this room about your problem and its answer than any other room on the face of the earth, except another room just like this where Alcoholics Anonymous members are meeting. So stay close to us. Get into as many meetings as you can. And I bought that. And I've still got it too. I've attended near 5 and 4 meetings a week for 34 years. And I've never attended one too many. And you might say, how do you know? My answer is very simple. I never had it so good. This is the only easy life I've ever known, the only good life that's ever been mine. And I'm not about to change a winning formula. It's no chore for me to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It's no chore for me to come to Texas or any place else in the world. Because, you see, I happen to love this program. And I happen to love its people. And I happen to love the life that has been mine now for 34 years. The next thing you told me was why I can't drink like other people. And of course, this is entirely too simple for us drunks. It's entirely too simple. The reason that we can't drink like the non-alcoholic drinker is that we're different. God damn, you can't spell that to an alcoholic, can you? We're different. It's too simple. We're different physically and mentally. If we be alcoholic, for some reason unknown to anybody, our bodies cannot handle alcohol successfully. We can't do it. When we take one drink, It sets up a physical craving that makes us continue to drink until our cycle is run. And there's nobody in the world that knows what causes that. We got a pretty good looking bunch of people here tonight. Pretty good bunch of people. If you weren't so happy, I couldn't tell you from normal people. But we can't drink liquor successfully. And we never will be able to drink liquor successfully. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. So we learn this and accept it and then turn to the other half of the disease. What our program is all about is to relieve us of the obsession to drink. To get rid of the obsession to drink. And that's what our program is built to do. The first 9 steps of the program for Alcoholics Anonymous will surrender anybody that will honestly take them for the reason that they were written. Sobriety. The first 9 steps are surrender steps. I happened to get here surrendered. I have lived 34 years without one conscious desire for a drink or a pill or anything else of that kind. I've been called a liar in open meeting on many occasions for saying that, but it's true. And I'm most happy that it's true. Because if I had had a conscious desire for drink, I'm afraid I would have gotten drunk. I always did. So I haven't had to do that. I'm very happy for it. But if you get here not surrendered, the first 9 steps of the program will surrender. That's what they're there for. That I am certain that those amongst us who have trouble with these surrender steps is that we have conditions on sobriety. Conditions. We want to get sober so we can get our job back, or our wives back, or our husbands back. We want to get sober so we can get the law for our heads. We want to get sober so we can get our jobs back. Conditions on sobriety. I think we got to get rid of all conditions on sobriety. We want sobriety for sobriety's sake. And then it works. I had as fine a grouping of related disorders as it is possible to put together, I think. I had no health, no sanity, no home, no job, and no money. Now, I don't think you get a nicer bunch of related disorders than that. That just covers the waterfront. And I never spent 5 seconds on any one of them. Not 5 seconds. And every one of them disappeared, along with the obsession to drink. And I never even knew when they'd gone. I never even knew when they'd gone. Now, I told you 2 or 3 times that I got here wanting nothing for myself. And I believe this is the hardest thing for anybody to understand. I can get my living room full of psychiatrists or PhDs, and I can say to them, did it ever occur to you what it'd be like not to want nothing, no time for yourself? And their chins drop. They look at me like I was a total imbecile. It's not normal not to want something. You're supposed to want something, you know. You're supposed to go someplace. You're supposed to be this, have that, and be known as. You know? I haven't been born in a family that's too poor to paint and too proud to whitewash. And we didn't have from nothing. And you had to get out there in the salt mine. And I think and I perform and I maneuver. Everybody else in order to eke out a miserable living out of an unfriendly universe. These are conditions that this civilization lays on us. And they're conditions that I haven't had for 34 years. I beat my brains out in the first 43 years of my life to get what I thought I was born without. 34 years ago, I started trying to rub out a record. And for the first 6 years, I explained my actions by saying I was rubbing out a record. And I want to tell you the series of awakenings as they came. After 6 months, I discovered I was sober. I hadn't had a drink or a pill for over 6 months. And that was a pretty good discovery. Now, I thought I didn't have enough left to get this thing. I never figured that I would be able to get sober and stay sober and live happily ever after. I didn't think I had enough left to get it. So I attended meetings for two reasons. Number one, it was comfortable there. And number two, I didn't have any place else to go. Now that helps a great deal. They ain't got no place else to go. And yeah, after 6 months, I discovered I haven't had a drink or pill. And I was so tickled that I immediately got lost trying to give this thing away. And another 6 months went by. And I discovered I had a family. And they were living like kittens. And this ain't a mean discovery either. It's pretty good. Now I have a little side remark to make on this. Not having a family, I had me a girlfriend that first year in Beverly. She was quite a girlfriend. She was probably 25 years my senior. She was a little bitty thing, and she lived up in big numbers, and she had big numbers. She's very, very wealthy. Her name is Louise, and all I had to do was call and say, Louise, how about a meeting tonight? She said, come and get me, and we'd take off. Well, sometime between the first 6 months and the first year, she called my house thinking to get me on the telephone. And she got Mrs. C. She says, who the hell are you? My wife says, well, I'm Chuck's wife. Didn't know he had a wife. And Mrs. C says, well, he doesn't either. And I didn't. But after a year, I discovered I had a family. And they were living like kittens. And that's not a bad discovery. Another 6 months went by, and I discovered I was still down there at the desk, at the office, trying to clean up my desk. And business was good. It was plumb good. And another year went by, and I discovered that my state of being was better than anything I'd ever known. It was just good to be alive, to breathe in and out. And that's not a bad discovery. And now 6 years have gone by, and I discovered I was never alone anymore. I had a guide of my very own. I, who had walked alone for a lifetime, always walked alone. And I was never alone anymore. I had a guide of my very own, and wherever I am, he is. And that was 6 years. And since that time, I've explained my actions as not trying to rub out a record, but trying to help God's kids do things they need to have done because I want to. And everything that I did, you remember our 12-step? It says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the first 11 steps. And then it gives us a lifetime course of action. We tried to carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. That's in everything we do. Home, play, business, AA, church, if we got one. Life. Practice the same principles in everything that we do. And when we do that, everything becomes one. And there's nothing more or less important than another. And there's nothing more or less spiritual than another. It puts us back together. We are made whole. Now, the discoveries never cease. I think that when we eventually have taken step 3, we enter a new dimension of life. An infinite father, an infinite child, and an infinite journey. In my opinion, 10,000 times 10,000 years from now, there'll still be as much ahead of us as there is today. An infinite father, an infinite child, and an infinite journey. I think we're the most fortunate bunch of peoples on earth. We drunks. Why? Because we have an incurable disease. And because our disease is progressive. And because the time comes when it's no longer possible to survive without an answer. And we come here, if we're fortunate. And by doing the things that the program tells us to do, we find an answer. And we don't have to drink anymore. And in my opinion, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is the finest formula that was ever conceived in the mind of man through the grace of God for obtaining and maintaining sobriety. But there are two other things that come with it. It's also the finest formula for the good life and for self-discovery. Self-discovery that I've ever heard about, read about, or seen. Now, out in our country, we have a great influx of youngsters, and we have a lot of oldsters that are nuts too, and many of them have decided that this program of ours is a program of self-improvement. Self-improvement. We have a great contingent out there that every time they stump their toe, they run home and write 15 pages about this little incident. And then they take 15 pages to their sponsor. And if they don't get the right answer, they take it to another sponsor. You know? And they try to figure out ways and means to beat these raps. Well, hell, if you and I could have beaten the rap, we'd have done it a long time ago. We would not be members of this leper colony if we could have done so much with our lives. It's not a self-improvement society, as far as I'm concerned. It's a self-discovery society. And we uncover and discover the thing that we've been looking for all our lives. Now, just for the fun of it, and I'll quit in a minute. I haven't lost but two, so I'm going to talk a little while longer. There goes the third one. uncover, discover, and discard. Now, the things that I'm going to say from now on in, I say not because I've read them someplace, but I've read them many places, but I say them because it happened to me. Now, in the last 34 years, my life has been nothing but one 12-step call. That's all it's been. At home, at business, in AA, in all the departments of my life, all I have done is make a 12-step call, trying to help God's kids do things they need to have done. And everything that I beat my brains out to get, for the first 43 years of my life, and ended up without, is now mine in spades. I never dreamed of a life like I've had. In my 11th year of sobriety, I bought the business that they were throwing me out of. And when I sold it, I was a wealthy man. And I never tried to get wealthy. I was just making a 12-step call in business. And my people made me wealthy. I didn't know it was happening until it was over. I fell on my face for 3.5 years. And I never even went to a doctor. There wasn't any sense in going to the doctor when you knew you were going to die. And I knew I was going to die. So I didn't go to the doctor. But after 3.5 years, I quit falling on my face. And I don't do it anymore. So that part of it worked out pretty good. I never spent 5 seconds trying to put my family life back together. And we have a family now. My wife and I have been married for 54 years. And in California, that's indecent. To be married to the same broad for 54 years. But we sort of like it that way. The boys and I can sit all night and talk. The boys wouldn't even come home when I was around. Now these are not bad living conditions. They're beautiful. And so, I have to believe that the gift of God was made at the foundations of the earth. He gave us himself and the universe in the very beginning. And he's always known this. But you and I have to discover it for ourselves. And we uncover it and discover it. I thought for the biggest part of my life that as soon as I knew enough, everything was going to be all right. But when I got to the place where I knew everything, there was nothing I didn't know. I couldn't even get out of bed and come and tell you what I knew. And for a philosopher of my ability, that's bad. So I now know that you can live yourself in the right thinking, but you cannot think yourself in the right living. Action is the magic word. You see? Out of my own life, it is proven that St. Francis knew what he was talking about when he says, "For it is in giving that we receive." You see? It's proven in my own life. Now, who else has thought like this over the years? There have been many, but I'm going to quote two or three. And they're mainly Catholic.
And I quote them because I'm not a Catholic. But they just happen to have said it like I like to hear it. In the first place, I think the carpenter man thought the same way. Because he said, says, I and my Father are one. He said, I am in the Father, and he and me, and I and you. He said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. All of those things he said, and that's just what I'm talking about. We uncover and discover the thing we've been looking for all our lives. There was a chap by the name of Brother Lawrence. He and I were boys together. It was back in 1566. He was washing pots and pans in a monastery right outside Paris. And he said everybody would be calling for something different at the same time. And he wouldn't pay any attention to them. He just went ahead washing pots and pans and talking to God. He said he never knew when his prayers of office started and stopped and his prayers began. And he became quite a counselor. And he said to one of his troubled friends, he says, he is within you. Look not for him elsewhere. There was a Dominican priest in Germany. And he said it like this. He said, you have heard that nature abhors a vacuum. I tell you that God abhors a vacuum. Can't abide a vacuum any place under heaven, however small. Now, says he, all you got to do is get empty of self. Surrender. And automatically, you're full of God. That's what he said. Now the last one, I'm going to quote, is in the Big Money. He was a saint. His name was St. Augustine, or St. Augustine, depending on how Irish you are. And I rather identify with him. Not after he became a saint. Before he became a saint. Because St. Augustine had a very strong weakness for whiskey. He drank a lot of that flit. Got in a lot of trouble. And he had a very strong weakness for good-looking gals. And he got into a lot of trouble there, too. And I sort of identified both of those categories. His mother prayed for him for 40 years. And every time he'd go by, he'd say, Mom, keep on praying. Someday it might happen. And one day it did. And here's what the old boy said about it in later years. He was talking to God. And this is what he was saying to God. He says, too late have I loved thee. Oh, thou beauty of ancient days yet ever new. Too late have I loved thee, and behold, thou wert within, and I abroad. And there I searched for thee, deformed I, plunging amidst the fair forms which thou hast made. Thou wert with me, but I was not with thee. That just describes my life to a T. Thou wert with me, but I was not with thee. And I see myself in the last days when I would get home and get the car in the garage. And my oldest son was bigger than I am by this time. And they wouldn't let me take the car out anymore. And if I would run out of my medicine in the night, I was in hell with my hat off. Because you got to have medicine, don't you? And so, I got to the place where I was commandeering the boys' bicycles. 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm running all over Beverly Hills trying to talk somebody out of a bottle of booze. And you'd be surprised how often I succeeded. But now I can look at that. I can sit and look at it. And I can see. Here I am pedaling down Elm Drive in Beverly. God's sitting right on my shoulders. And he's saying to himself, look at this silly son of a gun. Hunting all over Beverly Hills for me. And I'm with him all the time. God bless you. Thank you very much.